Good morning, my friends, from high above all other pedantic and puerile forms of Wyoming mainstream media, this is Cowboy State Politics. I, of course, am your illustrious host, David Iverson, sitting behind the silver Cowboy State Politics microphone and broadcasting to you from the base of the Bighorns in beautiful Buffalo, Wyoming. In an ever-changing, incomprehensible world, the masses had reached a point where they would, at the same time, believe everything and nothing, think that everything was possible, and that nothing was true. Mass propaganda discovered that its audience was ready at all times to believe the worst, no matter how absurd, and did not particularly object to being deceived, because it held every statement to be a lie anyhow. The totalitarian mass leaders based their propaganda on the correct psychological assumption that, under such conditions, one could make people believe the most fantastic statements one day and trust if the next day they were given irrefutable proof of their falsehood. They would take refuge in cynicism instead of deserting the leaders who had lied to them. They would protest that they had known all along that the statement was a lie and would admire the leaders for their superior tactical cleverness. What I just read to you should sound both very familiar and at the same time very descriptive of the time that we're living in. If you went to college any time before this absurdity that we call education now, 2002 or before, most likely, you would have been asked to read Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism. At the time, you most likely dismissed it as a relic of times gone past, of regimes that had been toppled. You probably incorrectly assumed that we've moved far beyond totalitarianisms and dictatorship. And yet today, we find ourselves being inundated by the same type of sophistry that was used those many years ago. I was struck yesterday by an article I was sent by Matthias de Smet entitled The Psychology of Totalitarianism. In it, he very clearly explains where we're at as a culture and how we can get out of it. After reading it, I immediately sent it to our friend Charles Cole. So this morning, a different type of discussion on the program about totalitarianism. But first, some completely egregious self-promotion. You can listen to the podcast on any of your favorite podcasting apps. iHeartRadio, iTunes, TuneIn, really any of them will work. But the easiest way is just to go to the website, cowboystatepolitics.com. There, you can find all of the shows, as well as any of the articles that I might bring up during the course of a program. If your name is Sleepy Joe Biden, and you're still trying to slip one by us Americans, and you can't figure out why it's not working, well, you can go to cowboystatepolitics.com, pull up an article, and figure it out for yourself. A quick program note. Next Thursday, not tomorrow, but next Thursday, we're going to have our first live broadcast, and it's going to start at 10 a.m. I've never done a live show before, so, well, I mean, I've done some candidate forums and whatnot, but not a live episode of the program. So we're going to start that next Thursday, and it's going to begin at 10 a.m. in the morning. Of course, after the show, I'll publish the live broadcast, so if you weren't able to tune in at 10 a.m., that you can listen to it at your leisure. I'm looking forward to it, and it should be a pretty good adventure. So, totalitarianism. For a long time, we conservatives have been called all sorts of names by the left. Here's just a few of them.
The MAGA Republicans are destroying America.
It's not surprising, then, that they get bitter and they cling to guns or religion or antipathy toward people who aren't like them.
I don't respect these MAGA Republicans. The MAGA Republicans don't just threaten our personal rights and economic security. They're a threat to our very democracy.
You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
Full of anger, violence, hate, and division. They embrace political violence. They don't believe in democracy.
Now that's just a few of them. But the icing on the cake came the day before yesterday from Sleepy Joe. He was speaking at a private fundraiser, so there wasn't any audio or video equipment around there. But there was a couple of reporters that caught what he said. Here's a report from PMS NBC on what the president said.
During a fundraiser last night, the president said, quote, "What we're seeing now is the beginning or the death knell of an extreme MAGA philosophy. It's not just Trump. It's the entire philosophy that underpins the, I'm going to say something, it's like semi-fascism." That's a quote.
Oh, so we small government types are the fascists. Interestingly enough, here's how the dictionary defines fascism. A system of government characterized by rigid one-party dictatorship, forcible suppression of the opposition, unions, other especially leftist parties, minority groups, etc., the retention of private ownership of the means of production under centralized governmental control, belligerent nationalism and racism, glorification of war, first instituted in Italy in 1922. Certainly sounds like we conservatives, doesn't it? Yesterday, on the Glenn Beck program, there was a pretty funny discussion of this whole semi-fascist comment that was coming out of the lips of sleepy Joe Biden. Instead of trying to recreate the whole thing, I figured I'd just play it for you. Here it is.
All right, so we're talking about semi-fascists, which I don't even know what a semi-fascist is. Is that somebody who's like, I like public partner, public-private partnerships, but I just don't want it with the, you know, the public, you know?
I don't think that's what it
no,
is.
No, it's not.
I think basically the semi is to act as if he didn't mean full fascist.
Oh,
which
okay.
is what he actually
so just
meant.
Acting.
Yeah.
Like,
it's
okay.
Joe Biden saying
he's such a good actor.
Republicans are fascists.
Right.
Because I guess they disagreed with him, which is interesting. It's a fascinating philosophy. And I'm a little confused because every time we get into a policy argument with people on the left, they don't call us fascists. They call us Wild West libertarians that want no restrictions on anything.
Oh, that's right.
And we just
that's
want
right.
a free-for-all.
Mm-hmm.
We're social
mm-hmm.
Darwinists. Mm-hmm. It's just everybody that we want these big companies to be able to take advantage, blah, 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 blah. So when we're talking about healthcare, we're like, oh, well, people should be able to go in the free market and choose whichever healthcare they want. Oh, you want the Wild West. So when you're talking about your philosophy, Glenn Beck. Mm-hmm.
Yes, my philosophy.
Can you describe it a little bit? What's your idea of what's your conservative utopia?
Well, I mean, it's quite long.
Give me a basic idea. Limited government, right?
Declaration of Independence, Constitution.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
A government that doesn't do very many things, as
correct.
You describe in this document.
It's what our country is supposed to be mm-hmm. according to the rules.
And maybe you'd summarize that as an experiment in self-governance, right?
I would.
As
I
the
would.
Founders
yeah,
described
I would
it.
Say, hey, is there a chance that maybe people can govern themselves mm-hmm. without an oppressive government?
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay, so
mm-hmm.
now let's hear what fascism is. This is
okay.
the
right.
textbook
mm-hmm.
definition. Political ideologies, their origins, and impact. Second edition. Mussolini. You may know him. Kind of a famous figure.
Love
he
him.
Created a totalitarian state.
Wait a minute.
Indeed, it was he who coined the word. So
huh.
I've got it. You'd think of that as almost like an insult. He actually did it
really?
Intentionally.
Ha. Huh.
Okay. He was not content with political power alone. He believed that the government and ultimately the government's leader should completely control every aspect of human existence. Consequently, like Stalin, Hitler, and Mao, which is weird that they pair those together, communists and fascists. Interesting. Consequently, like Stalin, Hitler, and Mao, he tried to build up the state's power, extending it into the most private aspects of the citizens' lives. More from Political Ideologies, Their Origins and Impacts. Quote, the state controlled and regulated almost every conceivable social, economic, and political activity of its citizens. Through this mechanism, almost every aspect of daily existence was controlled. Jobs. Wages.
Wait,
are we the ones that are arguing for wage controls? Fringe benefits. Are we the ones constantly telling every business what they must do with fringe benefits?
No,
is that us?
Okay. I don't think so.
Housing. Huh. Are we the ones constantly monitoring every little bit? Are we the ones saying you have to change all of your insulation? We have to redo every single building in America?
Yeah, but that's for the common good.
Retail goods. recreation, entertainment. Are we the people saying that we need to kick everybody off of every platform every time they make a joke you don't like? Are we controlling that? No, that's not us. Education. Are we the ones? Is that us? Are we the ones saying that you need to teach everybody about critical race theory and all these things that are not related to actual education?
Sure, it's not us.
They were all part of this elaborate organization. Now, since we mentioned critical race theory, let's think about that for a moment.
It's critical.
Critical. It's critical.
It's critical.
It's critical race theory. What about the idea that men are men and women are women? A basic thing that we've all understood for thousands of years.
Well, that's science.
That's that was science at one point.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because fascists had a particular approach to this exact type of thing. Something that we all understood as real hardcore science. They tended to take a different approach. May I describe it?
Yes,
from the textbook here.
Yeah.
You tell me which side this sounds like these days.
Okay. All right.
Fascism rejects objective science and reason. Objective truth is either a hoax or unimportant because the really important truths defy rational understanding. Those who believe in reason, therefore, are deluding themselves and grasping at a false reality. What is a woman, Glenn?
So whatever they accuse us of, that's what they're actually doing. In all seriousness, everything you're hearing is nothing but propaganda. Because, of course, propaganda is a necessary condition of a totalitarian state. Because totalitarianism has never worked, and I mean, it always leads to the deaths of millions of people. It doesn't make any sense. And so you have to be able to convince the populace of something that's not true. And that's why propaganda has to be continual and it has to be relentless. And you just can't let off the gas pedal at all. So the propaganda that you're hearing from the president that Republicans are the actual fascists is an attempt to get you to go along with all of their socialist policies. Another example of this is all of the talking points that you hear every single day on the news. They repeat the exact same language in different reports on different stations. It is a classic example of propaganda. Propaganda is defined as the ideas, doctrines, practices, etc. spread in any way that is systematic, widespread, deliberate indoctrination or a plan for such indoctrination, now often used in a derogatory sense, connoting deception or distortion. Deception or distortion. Now, we haven't seen anything like that in the last couple of years, now have we? Think about the pandemic. How many things have we been told that turned out just not to be true? Let me just give you a quick example.
And it's the unvaccinated people who it's going to make sick. And we really just cannot afford for you to have to go to the hospital right now.
Our data from the CDC today suggests, that vaccinated people do not carry the virus, don't get sick, and that it's not just in the clinical trials, but it's also in real world data.
A few months ago, I started taking up a kind of fairly bullish banner on COVID because the vaccines look so efficacious.
The situation is so clear. The data affirm if you get vaccinated, you are protected, even with the Delta variant.
Yeah, says the man who was vaccinated, triple boosted, quadruple boosted. I don't know how many shots he took, but he still got COVID. And everything they told us about this vaccine turned out to be a lie. Propaganda, pure and simple. And all of it was done to benefit the Democrat Party. Which brings me to the article that I mentioned earlier, The Psychology of Totalitarianism by Matthias de Smet. I highly suggest you read it. I've posted it both on the website and on the Cowboy State Politics Facebook page. You should really check it out. Allow me to read to you just a portion of it, and then we'll get to our discussion with Charles Cole. Quote, "At the end of February 2020, the global village began to shake on its foundations. The world was presented with a foreboding crisis, the consequences of which were incalculable. In a matter of weeks, everyone is gripped by the story of a virus, a story that was undoubtedly based on facts. But on which ones? We caught a first glimpse of the, quote, facts via footage from China. A virus forced the Chinese government to take the most draconian measures. Entire cities were quarantined, new hospitals were built hastily, and individuals in white suits disinfected public spaces. Here and there, rumors emerged that the totalitarian Chinese government was overreacting and that the new virus was no worse than the flu. Opposite opinions were also floating around that it must be much worse than it looked, because otherwise no government would take such radical measures. At that point, everything still felt far removed from our shores, and we assumed that the story did not allow us to gauge the full extent of the facts. Until the moment that the virus arrived in Europe. We then began recording infections and deaths ourselves. We saw images of overcrowded emergency rooms in Italy, convoys of army vehicles transporting corpses, morgues full of coffins, and the renowned scientists at Imperial College confidently predicted that without the most drastic of measures, the virus would claim tens of millions of lives. In Bergamo, sirens blared day and night, silencing any voice in a public space that dared to doubt the emerging narrative. From then on, story and facts seemed to merge, and uncertainty gave way to certainty. The unimaginable became reality. We witnessed an abrupt pivot of nearly every country on Earth to follow China's example and place huge populations of people under de facto house arrest, a situation for which the term lockdown was coined. An eerie silence descended, ominous and liberating at the same time. The sky without airplanes, traffic arteries without vehicles, dust settling on the standstill of billions of people's individual pursuits and desires. In India, the air became so pure that for the first time in 30 years, in some places, the Himalayas became once more visible against the horizon. But it didn't stop there. We also saw a remarkable transfer of power. Expert virologists were called upon as Orwell's pigs, the smartest animals on the farm, to replace the unreliable politicians. They would run the animal farm with accurate, quote, scientific information. But these experts soon turned out to have quite a few common human flaws. In their statistics and graphs, they made mistakes that even ordinary people would not easily make. It went so far that, at one point, they counted all deaths as corona deaths, including people who had died of, say, heart attacks. Nor did they live up to their promises. These experts pledged that the gates to freedom would reopen after two doses of a vaccine, but then they contrived the need for a third. Like Orwell's pigs, they changed the rules overnight. First, the animals had to comply with the measures because the number of sick people could not exceed the capacity of the healthcare system. That was called flatten the curve. But one day, everyone woke up to discover writing on the walls stating that the measures were being extended because the virus had to be eradicated. Crush the curve. Eventually, the rules changed so often that only the pigs seemed to know them, and even the pigs weren't so sure. Some people began to nurture suspicions. How is it possible that these experts made mistakes that every layman wouldn't make? Aren't they scientists? The kind of people who took us to the moon and gave us the internet? They can't be that stupid, can they? What is their endgame? Their recommendations take us further down the road in the same direction. With a new step, we lose more of our freedoms. Until we reach our final destination where human beings are reduced to a QR code in a large technocratic medical experiment. Now, the article goes on to explain that nearly everything that we experienced during the pandemic brought us one step closer to totalitarianism. I couldn't resist the urge to discuss this article with our friend Charles Cole. And we'll get to that next. But first, let's take a break and pay some bills. Cowboy State Politics is brought to you by Morton Buildings. Summer's almost over, guys. And that also means that construction season is almost over. So if you haven't called my friends Nick and Jesse at Morton Buildings, by the way, their phone number is 307-674-2532. You better get on it, because that white stuff is going to start flying around, and pretty soon that shiny motorcycle of yours is going to be living in a giant snowdrift. Nick and Jesse at Morton Buildings are the experts in metal building construction. They've been doing it longer than just about everybody else around, and they definitely do it better than anybody else around. So, doesn't matter what type of building you've been looking for, whether it's a barn or a roping arena or a garage or a giant warehouse or any type of metal structure, give them a call. The number's 307-674-2532, or you can check them out on their website at mortonbuildings.com. Right now is the highest we've ever seen gun markets, and the best performers are the vintage collectible firearms, Winchesters, Colts, and rare military weapons. Over in Cody, Gunrunner Auctions is one of the leading online auction houses in the country, and they're celebrating their 23rd year. Gunrunner Auctions is unique in that their specialty is estate firearms. They get calls all week long about lifelong gun collections coming to auction. Scott Weber, the owner, has been into firearms for almost 60 years, and he'll travel to the estate. He first appraises the firearms for the heirs and then takes them to his Cody auction facility, where he and his team research them, sometimes getting factory letters from the Cody Museum to learn more about each firearm's history. Every month, beginning on the 7th, Scott and his crew post 500 fine firearms for sale. All of them start at $20 with no reserve. Gunrunner Auctions only charges 15% for selling your firearms. Gunrunner Auctions has sold the personal firearms of Elvis Presley, Steve McQueen, Alex McCord, and Herb Parsons, just to name a few. With their 40,000 bidders in all 50 states, they'll realize the highest prices for your precious firearms. That's GunrunnerAuctions.com. And now, back to the program. For some time now, I've been trying to come up with a theory that explains the place that we're living in. Clearly, there's some sort of grand narrative that everybody is buying into, a grand narrative that obviously isn't true. We're seeing a postmodern deconstruction of what it is to be a human, but that in and of itself doesn't quite explain the situation that we're in. And then I read an article today by Matthias de Smet, entitled The Psychology of Totalitarianism. And it pretty much made all of those individual things gel for me. Now, there's only one guy I know that actually lived in a totalitarian regime, and he happens to know quite a lot about it, and that's Charles Cole. Welcome back to the program, Charles.
Thank you, David. Good to see you again.
So it's been a while since you've been on the program. Why don't you go ahead and take a minute or two and just remind our audience of who you are.
Okay, well, I am retired, and in former life, I used to be a professional Russian linguist and then Russian language teacher. So those duties involved with me, actually the performance while I was in the military of some military intelligence work directed against our dear Soviet friends, and then after I got my degree, I ended up going over on a cultural exchange exhibit to the Soviet Union in 1972. And I spent 6 months there traveling around a bunch of Soviet cities, exhibiting various things from mainly from American industry to Soviet citizens. And we got to speak to them in Russian about a whole host of things. So I was in a total of 9 Soviet cities over 6 months, met hundreds and hundreds of Soviets, had hundreds of conversations on some very interesting things, and I got to see a whole lot of things. I must say that back then I already pretty much knew where I was going because the old Russians that taught me Russian back in the army, 56 years ago, they had been escapees from that wonderland, and they pretty much filled us in, not only in the Russian language, but also they taught us a lot about communism. They taught us a lot about what it had done to their country. And then, of course, after I left there, 1972, I returned to the same place, the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California, and I taught Russian there for, just about 30 years before I retired. And in those duties, I interacted daily with literally dozens and dozens, and by the time I was done, hundreds and hundreds of former Soviet citizens. So it kind of, everything that I had learned was reinforced in person, traveling around the Soviet Union. And then everything I had learned there was reinforced by a full generation of people that had gotten out one way or another. So it all came about, and of course, I'm very interested in history. I enjoy studying it, and so
I expanded it out a little bit. I studied quite a bit. I was in Germany for 2 years, and I studied a little bit also about the wonderful East German Democratic Republic. Yeah, Democratic Republic. So, kind of a broad stroke. I've been following it for, I guess, over 50 years now, and I still listen just about every night. I've got some friends of mine that are former residents of that wonderful place, Louisville, and they, a couple of them are in the media in New York and Chicago, and they do YouTube stuff every evening. So I listen in, and every once in a while I do an interview in Russian with them just so I can still do it. But, so that's kind of a thumbnail sketch. It took a long, long time to reach the point where I guess when I wrote my first book, which was In Russian Wonderland, An American's Odyssey, Soviet Russia, I used a lot of the things that I had collected over the years as examples, and I reflected upon the things that I saw in daily life in the Soviet Union. And then, gosh, I woke up one day here in the United States of America, and I started seeing things, and I said, wait a minute, this is like a flashback. I'm having dreams here of things that I never dreamed I would see in this country. I mean, the media, the government, of course, Holly Weird, and the rest of that. I mean, it's gone to the point now where they clearly had jumped the shark, I think, during the Obama administration. And now with this crew basically following the orders, I think, people who are still around in Washington, D.C. Now I'm afraid they've jumped the shark. We see things that the FBI is routinely doing, for example, that, I mean, this is literally KGB-esque. This is like East Germany, Stasi-land. This can't go on. It just can't. And so I have tried my writings in some podcasts that I've been a part of. So I just try to bring to people's attention, look, what we're facing, my hypothesis, is a disease, and I call it TOC, T-O-C, totalitarian oligarchical cult. And I think that wraps itself around everything from the French days, the Jacobin days in France, all the way up to today in Venezuela. And it's amazing how little it has changed. And it's frightening to hear people actually support some of these things willingly. They had an election in New York, the primary election there, and I saw in some report that this young woman, an AOC type, had won a primary contest for either state office or maybe in Congress, and she was dancing around singing to her supporters, "Socialism wins." And you know, you look at this and you just sometimes I'm just, believe it or not, I'm just gobsmacked. I can't think of what to say because it's just so surrealistic.
Well, and that's kind of where I'm at, Charles. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you know, I've been trying to wrap my head around exactly what is going on. And I've got all the pieces there. And it wasn't until I read this article, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, that it all kind of gelled together for me. And as you and I were discussing earlier this afternoon, one of the most poignant lines in this article is that totalitarianism is not a historical coincidence. It is the logical consequence of mechanistic thinking and the delusional belief in the omnipotence of human rationality. That kind of encapsulates the whole thing, that we've obviously removed God from the equation. And we've convinced ourselves of our own omnipotence in reason and science, or what they call science. And it's led to a whole host of, we might even call them atrocities. Maybe not the millions of deaths that were predicted during the pandemic. The atrocities that I'm talking about are people voluntarily giving up their liberties, you know, for the sake of, you know, what would you call it? A groupthink, or you've got a term for it. What is it?
Collectivism.
Ah, collectivism, of course.
And so, that's exactly the point that the fellow, that was a very good article, by the way. Thank you for sending me that. I scanned it once and then read it in detail later. And I agree with most of what he has said. I could take issue with a couple of little things here and there, but the main thing he pointed out was that this reaches a point in time when it becomes mechanical. He mentions the introduction that he quotes from Hannah Arendt, whom I know you know,
yep,
know about, and she wrote extensively on totalitarianism. I still, every once in a while, take a look at her book, although it's 70 years old now, she put it, The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt. And there are things in there that, again, you see examples of it. And the most dangerous thing, what she found, I found her work very interesting. After she wrote that book, she was invited by, I think, the New Yorker magazine, I might be wrong about that source, but someone there in New York, one of the publishers, invited her, gave her a contract to travel over to Israel and attend the trial of Adolf Eichmann, the great SS mind behind the Holocaust. And she came back astounded. She said, I thought I was going to find this monster. But the guy was just basically, because she was lucky because his testimony is all in German. She was a native speaker of German. She didn't have to wait for the translation. And she said, I was astounded by the fact that this guy was basically a nobody. He was a functionary, a bureaucrat. He even said, and I remember this from watching snippets from that testimony, even said things like, well, you know, I was only, as others have said, following my orders that I received. And, for example, you don't condemn the personnel who loaded the RAF and the American Air Force planes with bombs that then were dropped on Germany and killed a lot of Germans. You don't. And he says, and like those guys that loaded the bombs, I never killed anybody. She ended up calling all this the banality of evil. And she was quite right about it, because we see examples of people who are otherwise rational or seemingly rational, intelligent people, and yet the things that they come to believe are indescribably stupid. I sent you today something that Larry Elder had recently posted. He found 9 wonderful quotes starting back in 69 and running it to today, to 2019, actually, about, the dire climate. And then year after year, they have predicted this, by the way, for the past 100 years, actually, that, you know, pretty soon the coasts are going to evaporate and then everything's going to be underwater and we're all going to burn up. Either it's an ice age or then it's global warming. Well, now it's just old climate change. And none of it has come true. And yet, we now have an administration which is calling for, several months ago, I was flabbergasted to read that the Biden administration had made a statement saying, well, by 2025 or 2026, I think it was, we want to convert all the military tanks to electric vehicles.
Yeah, I saw that. Ridiculous.
You stop and think about that for a minute. That is so ludicrous that you'd have to be, mentally deranged to believe that. And yet, when they passed this legislation, the most recent one, about the dealing with inflation, yeah, blah, blah. That's nothing more. When you take it all apart, put it back together again, that's nothing more than a climate change. It throws gazillions of bucks at projects that just, and you ask these people, I have asked several young people that I know grew up in this world of where they believe in man-made science, the science, so quote unquote, of man-made global climate change. You ask them, well, tell me, so you want everything electric. Where does the electricity come from?
They don't know.
A couple of them have actually said to me, well, you plug the thing in the socket, and there it is. And I said, okay, but that's electric. Where does the electricity charge the batteries come from? And it's like, ask them kind of Einstein nuclear physics question. It's just God.
The whole point that I wanted to get at with this is, how do people become so convinced of ideas that are so absurd?
You know, that tanks can run on electricity, that men can decide that they're women, and women can decide that they're men, and that man is influencing the climate. I mean, how do people come to believe in almost a, well, it's not almost, it's definitely a religious sense that these things are actually true? I mean, when we look back at history, Charles, you had people during the Holocaust or right after it that lived right beside a concentration camp, and they swore up and down that they didn't know that it was there. So how do people, and you know, from your experience, how do people become so convinced of things that are so absurd that no objective person would believe them? And yet we're living at a time where, you know, people just they believe the craziest of things. That we can run everything on electricity without anything that generates it. I mean, how do people come to that belief, Charles?
Well, I think in a number of ways, and it depends on which way the disease starts. You have instances such as in France in 1789, where, and the Soviet Union, Russia in 1917, where there's all of a sudden this violent turbulence, this earthquake of an event that takes over, and then the powers that be then assume power, they seize power, and from that moment on, whatever they say goes, and they control it through fear. Fear is the driver, all of it. Now, sometimes it starts less dramatically. The great example for us in America today, I think, is Venezuela. This was one of the most affluent countries in South America, if not the most. And yet, in the 1990s, they were convinced by one of the old siren songs that we have to, what did Barack Obama say? Spread the wealth around. We have to do more equity and all this. And they went to the polls and they voted it in. And then what happens is the process starts, because as soon as those people garner power, they're going to use the traditional methods. They're going to start the propaganda. They're going to start the censorship. They're going to start the tactics of fear. They're going to disarm the regular people and arm the police, et cetera, and the military to the hilt. And all of a sudden, then one day you turn around and you say, my gosh, it's too late to do anything about it. And this is my point, especially to young Americans. Stop and think. Because the other thing that happens is, of course, one of the supporting pillars of all this is education. If you infest the education community with like-minded true believers, and then you just fast forward for a couple of generations, because, again, in a society such as ours, everybody's busy living their own lives. That's great. That's freedom. That's liberty. But sometimes we're too busy to even check out what our children are being told in school. This was one of the benefits, if you will, side benefits of the COVID thing, when people started to see through the homework that was sent home via Zoom, et cetera. They saw some of this stuff, like the CRT and the 1619 project. And they say, whoa, what are you doing? Well, the education feature of that goes along with the media propagation of it. And pretty soon you reach a point where, as Hannah Arendt said about Eichmann, you lose the ability to think. A lot of it, David, is fear-driven. If you look at these various societies, always compulsion rather than conviction. I don't need to convince you of anything. I'm in power. You'll do what I say or else. That's one of the great drivers right there.
There's a great line in this article, and it's coercive control leads to fear, and fear leads to more coercive control. This way, society falls victim to a vicious cycle that leads inevitably to totalitarianism.
Exactly. Unless that chain is broken. And that was the point of the fellow's article. He says, look, he said our greatest weapon is what he calls the language of truth speech. stop and think about what you're being told. Because people have not totally yet, most people, lost the ability to reason. Eventually, if this continues long enough, they will. I had conversations with Soviet people, Russians, in Russian, where I would, one of them, I described in my first book, I said I was trying to describe that this woman walked up to me and she said, what is this business you have of multiple political parties? And so I'm trying to describe to her the process of the competition of ideas, et cetera. And this woman, who I think by then was, she's in her 60s probably, grown up there, all she ever knew was communism, the Communist Party. And she said, well, but our Communist Party takes care of everything for us. Our education, our health care, this and that, our food, our safety, security. And I said, well, yes, but couldn't that process be improved upon if you had competing ideas within that same society? She looked at me like I fell off out of a tree, and she said, her words literally, well, that's just chaos. Walked away. So it reaches a point where the person then is incapable of even considering alternatives because they've been so brainwashed, so ideologically poisoned, that they, as Hannah Arendt said, they lose ability.
You know, one crucial component of all of this is propaganda. The propaganda has to continue, and it has to be relentless so that people continue to believe what they're told. And one point he brings up is that once that cycle of propaganda stops, then the collapse of the totalitarian regime doesn't follow that far after.
Yeah, but again, that point has to be reached. And what he was referring to is that unless that propaganda, supported by the education, the media, the culture, all this stuff, unless it is, as he says, ongoing and nonstop, if it does take a pause even, people are liable to then start checking out, I don't know, other sources. For example, why would you want to listen to MSNBC and CNN when you can listen to David Iverson?
Well, I completely agree with that.
David Iverson, you see, becomes a very dangerous figure in that because he's now an enemy of the state because he doesn't conform. His broadcasts don't conform to the narrative, and therefore they don't propagate the agenda that the narrative requires. That's the danger for them, and that's the reason why one of the other features of all these regimes is propaganda and censorship. Blatant censorship. When I first got to Moscow in 1972, we were staying in a fairly nice hotel. I looked up and there was this little radio on the shelf. So I looked at it and I fiddled around with it. And I realized pretty soon that there were two options on that radio, on or off. So you either listen to Radio Moscow or you didn't listen to anything. American signals, foreign signals, Radio Liberty, Radio Free, all jammed. So, and by the way, it was made a crime, as it was in Nazi Germany, same Soviet Union. It was a crime punishable by some pretty severe thing. So again, the message has to be one, and it has to be everywhere, and it has to be constantly. Rush Limbaugh used to love doing this. He put together one of these montages, and he'd say, "Here's the talking point for the day," and he would. You'd listen to all these sources, and the vocabulary was exactly the same. Word for word.
There's a couple of radio hosts that do that, and it's like you said, it really is the talking point for the day in the exact same words. It really is a symptom of, or a consequence, or a symptom of, you know, if you hear a lie enough, you start to believe it. You know, in the article, the guy mentions in 1979, there was what he called a mass formation, which is what the essential point of his article is, that in Iran, people were convinced that they could see the face of the Ayatollah Khomeini on the moon. And so when there were full moons, people would go out into the street and point at the moon and, you know, marvel, how could it be that their leader's face was on the moon? I mean, that's an absurd conclusion to draw. I mean,
I mean, interrupt you, but I've seen similar things And if you watch some of the documentaries about the Soviet years, you'll see as they interviewed some people who had somehow survived the camps and gotten back. One guy was telling one interviewer, he says, well, he said, we were so taught to believe that Joseph Stalin was simply, he was a god with a small g, he was infallible. We believed that if he wanted to perform brain surgery, but he said there were people in the camps who were sending letters to Stalin saying, if only Comrade Stalin knew about these abuses, he would fix all this. When it was Joseph Stalin who had sent them there in the first place. The great example that I use on the media example is, I'll never forget this as long as I live. We were in Donetsk in the Ukraine. I decided one day to walk to the exhibit pavilion rather than take our little bus. And I walked by it was a Soviet cafeteria. It was mainly for the coal miners. It's heavy mining, still is, I guess. And I had just looked. I picked up an issue of Pravda, and I was reading it on the way over to the cafeteria. And on the front page, in the left hand column, they would call that the lead column in Pravda, communist newspaper, and it had these points. 1, 2, 3, 4. It was sort of like the montage of the talk. And this one was focused on, it was in September, I think, 72. And the headlines read, record harvest. Absolute records are being broken by Soviet agriculture and harvest. Da, 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 da. So then I get into the cafeteria and I'm going through the buffet line there. And there's a little place where they just display the bread. That's for bread. There were a couple of end pieces left and crumbs. And I looked at that, and up above it was a sign in Russian that read, translates to bread for your meal. Bread is a treasure. Preserve it. Wait a minute. So we've got a record harvest, and yet bread is in supply. The interesting thing, though, is the Soviets looked at that, and they never thought a thing about it. First of all, because that had reached stage 5 of the terminal disease, and even if they had noticed it, so what? What are you going to do about it? By that time, it's too late. That's why I think all of us need to make a major effort to try to avoid this country ever getting to that stage of it. Because by then, it's academic. It's too late. Think, people, while you can. Not illegal yet, please. And I try to get people to understand, you must break out of the routine media cycle. If all you do every day is read the Casper Star Tribune, the Sheraton Press, the New York Times, and as all you listen to or watch is MSNBC, CNN, et cetera, then you are going to be subject to this never-ending propaganda, because all of that is narrative and agenda-driven. You have to find alternative sources of information, which then you can use to compare with what the other side says. And that they fear more than anything. Look how the social media stuff is censored and block people out, deplatform them, et cetera. It's all part of the overall effort. Make sure that the David Ivertsons of the world don't get heard and that the Liz Cheneys do. That's.
So one last question I had for you, Charles, is in this article, he doesn't really go through a timeline of totalitarianism follows. You know, I mean, certainly there are historical mileposts that we could mark with just about every totalitarian regime. Where do you think we are right now in the United States?
Well, to be honest with you, I think we're on a very dangerous precipice. I think I've told my wife many times, I'm looking at this November election this year, that if somehow the Democrat Party manages to gain one or two seats in the Senate, giving it control there, whereby they kill the filibuster, and if they somehow retain control of the House, you're going to see things speed up in the sense that if you think there's censorship now, just wait. If you think the FBI is overbearing and, shall we say, somewhat tyrannical, just wait. All the signs that we're seeing are potential. The seeds are all there, and they intend to water it full bore ahead. So, my gosh, folks, get out, register, vote, make your thoughts heard and known. Talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends, whether they're here in Wyoming or whether they're stuck in Ohio or Tennessee somewhere. Talk to them, because what the totalitarians fear most of all is the open exchange of information. And when the more information that gets out about what's really going on, the worse it is for them. I'm afraid we're approaching a stage, though. Again, we're going to know a lot of those answers, I think, after November, because we're getting way too close for me. I'm lucky. I'm an old guy. Even though my America that I was born and raised in is pretty much, never in mind, here in Wyoming, we're very, very lucky to have so much of that still left. But the point is, it's like any other disease. You better diagnose it. You better treat it. And the sooner the better, because it ain't going to get better unless you do. And it's going to metastasize, and then it'll simply be too late to talk about it.
I think I would be remiss if I didn't try to get you to tell us what the topic of your column is in this month's Conservative Chronicle.
What's in September when it's coming out?
Yeah.
What did I write that on? I think I wrote it on the broad topic of active citizenship. We tend, even here in Wyoming, we tend to think, okay, we go to the polls, we vote for the candidate of our choice, and that's it. Then our part of the game is over. Wrong. We have to stay completely informed. I think what I suggest in this article and in this month is every Republican candidate throughout the state of Wyoming, I don't care what office they're running for, we have to get them on the record. Sir or madam, what do you think about crossover voting? What do you think about Title 22, the election code? What do you think about the election integrity, drop boxes and all that? Put them on the record as to what they think and make them say, I will vote that way. Then make sure they know we're going to watch. We're not going to stop. We're not going away. So if you think you can just give us the little injection of Novocaine once every 2 years and then go about your business, that has to end. It's got to end now.
You know, it's fascinating that yours and my column tend to coincide a lot. And, you know, mine this month is that the conservatives won. Maybe we didn't win all of the seats, but it was very clear that Wyoming citizens with a capital C, by the way, are very tired of people telling them one thing and then doing another when they get to Cheyenne. You know, in almost every case, a conservative won, or they just very, very narrowly lost. And, you know, I don't think that'll send a message to the redcoats that are in Cheyenne. But I think it's a very good sign as to where we're headed this November. And, you know, in Wyoming, most of our elections happen in the primary. There's only a few that are decided in the general election. I think the election that people need to be focused on, one, is our state, and two, is what happens with the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate. You know, but I agree with you that we're on a dangerous precipice, because just look at what the Democrats have done, you know, in 2 years. I mean, it's honestly, it's remarkable, you know, how far they've been able to go. And, you know, if they take full control of the Senate and they manage to hang on to the House, we definitely will not recognize our country in 2024.
Yeah, I think we're very fortunate, ironically, to have had two of the 50 Democrat senators, Manchin and Sinema, who stood up to their party and said, no, we're not going to bag this filibuster rule. They wanted that so badly, because if they could have done that, then everything's a 50-50 vote. Kamala Harris casts the tiebreaker. They've got the House. They would have passed that Voting Rights Act and federalized every single election. I think in that case, you know, somebody like Liz Cheney could have won Wyoming with, I don't know, 400,000 votes. because that's how many they would go ahead and produce and stuff them in the drop boxes and you just go ahead and prove that they're not. It's very dangerous. That's why I think, as a matter of fact, the title of my article is When Politicians Say One Thing, Do Another. That has got to stop in Wyoming, and it's got to stop in Washington, D.C., too. What the RNC is doing right now, I don't understand. I think you and I could write better ads than what I've seen them doing. I don't know. We'll see. But November this year, it's just think of D-Day. That's where we are.
Well, Charles, thank you once again for coming on the program.
Thank you, David. You have a nice evening, too.
Well, that'll do it for today's installment of the program. Now, don't forget, next Thursday, starting at 10 a.m., will be our first live program. It's going to be for about an hour. I've never done it before, so it should be a pretty good adventure. Well, have a good rest of your week, and we'll talk again on Saturday. From the base of the Bighorns in beautiful Buffalo, Wyoming, I'm David Iverson, and this is Cowboy State Politics.